Next Wednesday, Frank and I will be in Dallas, Texas. We'll be at at Fort Worth. We'll be at the Grace Evangelical Society National Conference. And I have three papers I'm presenting, and Frank will be dealing in a panel discussion on the how to give the good news, how to tell people about Jesus Christ and his free gift of everlasting life. So we should have a very good time. Before we begin with the message, I'd like to show you something that it's turning out that we're getting approval on, but it's still in a preliminary form. The back of our trailer is going to look something along this line. The front of the trailer, and notice how that's the thought provoker and phone number, which will have a cell phone that will be dedicated to Message of Life. That number will be given. And our website address. Now looking at what the trailer, now this is superimposed on it, so it's not really there, if you know what I mean. And on the front, thirsty. We figure that even when we're on divided freeways that are pretty far apart, there will be some passengers who may notice that as they're coming up and may be able to spot the information. And then as we're driving through town or we're at gas stations or things like that, it'll be a thought provoker. We're planning to be able to have a display of living waters for when we're parked so that people can take living waters even if we're not present. So now I'll show you the side. Drink the living water Jesus gives and never thirst again, which is a paraphrase of John 4:13. We figure that even if people don't contact us after the thought provoker of thirsty, they may say, okay, wonder what that's all about, and if they have a Bible, they may take a look at it. So even if they don't contact us by giving a reference with a thought provoker, we may get people to actually take a look in their text. Then we have our logo on the left-hand side, Message of Life, John 3:16, and those little symbols that you see around there are infinity signs, which is a way of suggesting the idea of everlasting life. Let's see. Actually, I've got... These are infinity signs. So, yeah, it's obviously meant for a little larger screen than we have here. Then we have drops of water depicted, and let's see, this, I haven't found my red dot here this time. There are drops of water. This is George's designing. They're into a pool and the spreading ripples. And then in here, George put the mathematical formula that yields this graphic right here. Diane suggested that he put himself in there somehow, so that's what he did in the center of that. Then we'll have living waters. At this point, this is just a low-quality graphic. We've been supplied with higher-quality graphics, and instead of just having it in Spanish and English like we do, it'll be Spanish, French, and English depicted. And then we say distributing Gospels of John for free. And we're thinking about adding a little more there and saying in several languages. So we're trying to make it so that people will have a reason to contact us, that we're a billboard even as we're going down the freeway. And as we stop overnight in motels and things like that. So anyway, it's a pretty exciting prospect here of being able to let people know about this, even apart from the people that we'll actually be able to speak with. So, let's see, I've got a blue light on here that I don't have a clue what to do with. This must be Kmart, you know, the blue light special. So, let's begin with a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for this evening. We thank you for your word and for giving us this time to gather together to learn from you. As Joseph said in our passage, that you are the one who is in charge of the interpretation of dreams, and you are also in charge of revealing to man what we could not know on our own. We thank you for the provision that you have made for Israel, even at a time where they were quite vulnerable, and we thank you that you protect them in this day and age when they are also quite vulnerable. We thank you that your promises are true and that we can always rely upon them. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. One year after Diane and I were married, on July 15th, 1979, Jimmy Carter's most famous speech was given. The Malaise Speech. I will read you some excerpts out of that. Now, this is a history lesson. It's not contemporary politics. I know, of course, being president, that government actions and legislation can be very important. That's why I've worked hard to put my campaign promises into law, and I have to admit, with just mixed success. But after listening to the American people, I have been reminded again that all the legislation in the world can't fix what's wrong with America. So I want to speak to you first tonight about a subject even more serious than energy or inflation. I want to talk to you right now about a fundamental threat to American democracy. The symptoms of this crisis of the American spirit are all around us. For the first time in history, in the history of our country, a majority of people believe that the next 5 years will be worse than the past 5 years. We were sure that ours was a nation of the ballot, not the bullet, until the murders of John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. We were taught that our armies were always invincible and that our causes were always just only to suffer the agony of Vietnam. We respected the presidency as a place of honor until the shock of Watergate. We remember when the phrase, sound as a dollar, was an expression of absolute dependability until 10 years of inflation began to shrink our dollar and our savings. We believed that our nation's resources were limitless until 1973 when we had to face a growing dependence on foreign oil. He says, these wounds are still very deep. They have never healed. Looking for a way out of this crisis, our people have turned to the federal government and found it isolated from the mainstream of our nation's life. Washington, D.C. has become an island. The gap between our citizens and our government has never been so wide. And you know what his solution was? I'm asking you for your good and for the nation's security, to take no unnecessary trips, to use carpools or public transportation whenever you can, to park your car one extra day per week, to obey the speed limit, and to set your thermostats to save fuel. I've seen the strength of America in the inexhaustible resources of our people. In the days to come, let us renew that strength in the struggle for an energy-secure nation. That speech defined his presidency. But then, it's an interesting thing. We had a man who came into the presidency that didn't have such a limited view. And during his presidency, the Berlin Wall fell. Stagflation came to an end. You know, stagflation was what characterized the Carter years. Stagflation is when the economy is stagnating and there's still inflation. Remember the misery index? Well, it was a really tough thing to fight stagflation. Politicians usually don't have the guts to do it. Because what you need to do in order to cause the economy to get out of stagnation causes inflation to increase. And what you do to bring inflation under control makes stagnation even worse. And so basically what was going on during the Carter administration, and again this is a history lesson, was do a little bit to encourage the economy and do a little bit to stop inflation, which did a little bit to do nothing. Reagan took a much more direct approach and initially, because of some of the economic policies, unemployment did rise. But then over a period of time, because of the tax cuts that were implemented, companies started to expand, the employment base grew, and the economy worked its way out of stagflation into a time of prosperity without high inflation. Why is this history lesson pertinent? Egypt, during the time of Joseph, was used to great prosperity. And we'll get into an explanation of why they were used to such great prosperity. And after the introduction, you'll notice Egypt and the reliability of the Nile. What I have here is a picture that shows the Nile from space. Egypt, Nile River, Mediterranean Sea. And what is it that you notice as you look at the Nile River? What color is it? The area is green. What's surrounding it? Desert. The Nile River is the only reason that Egypt is able to sustain a sizable population. But why is it that the Nile River is so dependable, and why is it that they had a complacency about it? Well, if you look at the map here on the right-hand side, it's showing Africa with all of its river, major river basins throughout the continent. And the portion of the Nile of Africa that is drained by the Nile River is indicated by the red circle. The Nile River is 4,000 miles long, the longest river in the entire world. And it stretches from south to north. When you look at weather patterns, because of the Earth spinning, weather patterns tend to go from west to east rather than from north to south or south to north, which means that a very long river is going to have completely different weather in one area compared to another. Let's turn to another map. If we were to go from Southern California to Prudhoe Bay, up on the north slope of Alaska, it would be a 4,000-plus mile road trip. Compare that with the 4,000 miles there of the Nile River. Now, you know, it's quite a drive as you pass Sacramento, pass Portland, pass Seattle, get way up into the Yukon, continue driving north, get to Fairbanks, and then continue north further and further and further. What's the weather like up in the Northwest compared to here in Southern California? Lots of precipitation up there, not down here. If you have a river that is as long as the Nile River, you can have one area going through a drought and another area that is being inundated with moisture. And what happens? All that ends up down in the Nile River, and it flows out past Egypt, and they could count on it. They never had long-term floods. Long-term droughts. On the other hand, look at Israel. What's the longest river in Israel? The Jordan. And it dumps into the Dead Sea, and you can't do anything down there. And it's only a couple hundred miles of twisty river. How much difference do you have between the weather on the north end and the south end of the Jordan River? Not a great deal. Israel does not have the dependability of a river like the Nile. Egypt did. The Nile River was a major reason that Egypt had economic stability that allowed it to become a powerhouse just from the fact of that river. It rarely rains in Egypt. It rains there even less often than it does in Phoenix. Even less often than it does in many parts of the California desert. But they have the Nile River. And as a result, you look at a map, even you look at a satellite picture, and there's green throughout that region because of the areas that are watered by the Nile always have water. Now, if you're always depending on the Nile and you say, wow, you know, we can always depend upon it, how likely is a government like that to make long-term plans for a major drought? They didn't. Actually, I'd like to take a little digression. Turn to the book of Zechariah. That's next to the last book in your Old Testament. It's talking about during the millennial kingdom, the observation of the Feast of Tabernacles by Gentiles. We'll start at verse 16 Zechariah 14. The next to the last chapter of the next to the last book of the Old Testament. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations, that is Gentiles, which came against Jerusalem, shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. And Egypt could be saying, well, that's not a problem. We've got the Nile River. So there's a special clause here for Egypt because they don't depend on it raining on Egypt. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. So other nations have no rain, but Egypt has a special issue there because that wouldn't be a punishment for them. God has to take care of them in a special way because of the Nile River. So, as we consider Genesis chapter 41, we are going to see how God revealed to Joseph the interpretation of a pair of dreams by Pharaoh, something totally outside of the thinking of Pharaoh that there could ever be economic calamity of the type that is described. They had no way of interpreting the dreams, and they had to turn to the source of the dreams, that is God himself, through Joseph. When we get into later chapters, we will talk about the centralized control, the governmental controls that are going to be implemented in Egypt. I do not see the Bible making an endorsement of the centralized controls, even though Joseph was in charge of it. And let me explain why. In Egypt, first reason, in Egypt, they all already had centralized control. And all that was happening was the centralized control that already existed was going to be put under a man who knew what God had decreed. So it was not implementing centralized control on a people that did not have centralized control. But it was just using it in a different way for the provision of both Egypt, Israel, and other nations of the world. But the second and even stronger evidence that it was not set forth as the way God wants things done, God did not institute centralized control of the type that they had in Egypt during the 14 years upon Israel. You look at the Old Testament and you don't see God imposing that. What you have is there already was a centralized government, but it was a centralized government in ignorance. They would not have known what to do in the face of calamity. And it was not a change of the style of government, but instead it was an informing of them with Joseph at the head of the program in order to make sure that things worked. Okay, let's now look at where Pharaoh has his two dreams. Genesis chapter 41, and we'll be covering a large segment, so we are obviously going to move. In verses 1 through 8, Pharaoh had two dreams which none could interpret. Then it came to pass at the end of two full years. So Joseph has been imprisoned after being falsely accused by Potiphar's wife for 2 years, that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river, that is, by the Nile. Suddenly there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then, behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows ate up the 7 fine-looking and fat cows. So Pharaoh awoke. He slept and dreamed a second time, and suddenly 7 heads of grain came up on one stalk, plump and good. Then behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, that's a Santa Ana, sprang up after them. And the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh awoke, and indeed it was a dream. Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled, and he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men, and Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. In verses 1 through 4, Pharaoh's first dream was about 7 gaunt cows eating 7 fat ones. Now, as you notice here, Pharaoh has dreams, and at the end of the dream, he's left perplexed, isn't he? And none of his advisors know the answer. This passage is showing a government that's out of control because it doesn't have any guidance from the Word. History teaches those lessons. Well, Pharaoh is by the river in his dream, and he sees coming out of the river 7 nice-looking cows. Now, you look here at these pyramids, and you know the searing heat in Egypt. But where is it that this takes place? And why is it the cows are coming out of the river? With that heat, cows and water buffalo like to get into the water of the Nile. It's a place to cool down. It's a natural place for them to come, but why is it that they come out? They're going to eat in a meadow. You can be cool in the water, but notice they came out to eat. Notice in verse 3, or verse 2, they came up out of the river, and they fed in the meadow. This is a natural picture. This is something he would expect. And because of the greenery and because of the lush vegetation, cattle did well. So he's saying, okay, all is fine and well. But then it's very troubling that out of the river come ones that you can see the bones. They are skinny. They are gaunt. And they come up and they eat these other cows. And the funny thing, even though little, skinny, emaciated cows should be getting full when they eat fat cows, they remain skinny and gaunt. He's saying, this is obviously the Nile River. This is obviously Egypt. What is this about these skinny cows? What's going on? And he doesn't have a clue. So then he has a second dream. In verses 5 through 7, his second dream was about seven thin heads of grain. Whoops. You can scratch out cows. You can see copy and paste at work. Eating seven plump ones. And so as he has the second part of this, he sees fine grain, obviously watered by the irrigation systems that proceeded from the Nile River. And he's saying, okay, everything's fine. And then all of a sudden, there's some grain that just doesn't look like it came from Egypt. And again, you have grain that eats other grain, just like you had cows that eat other cows. He's saying, this is a very strange dream. And they're blighted by that east wind, by that Santa Ana. And he woke up. So, immediately, what does this mean? Dreams have a very special importance within the life of Joseph, if you remember. Joseph had two dreams, did he not, that are recorded for us. One where he saw the sheaves of his brothers bowing down before his sheaf. And the other where the sun, you had the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars. And everyone could perceive that the whole family was bowing down to Joseph. And Joseph never doubted those dreams. And we know that because what happened when the cupbearer and the baker came up and they were dejected, and Joseph asked, well, why are you so sad? He said, well, we've had dreams and no one can interpret them. And Joseph said, yeah, you know, I had some dreams once upon a time and I thought I knew what they meant, but I have not a clue. No. Joseph said that he could interpret dreams. Joseph had not given up on those dreams, even though it looked pretty far from being fulfilled. Remember, he was put into a pit, sold to Midianite slave traders, and ended up as a slave, falsely accused of adultery or attempted rape, and then thrown into prison. And he still believes the dreams that he had. So he interprets those two dreams, and the cupbearer is elevated, and the baker is executed by Pharaoh. So now it comes time that there is more revelation from God to these Gentiles that is taking place by way of dreams. Dreams for Pharaoh. Pharaoh understood that the dreams were important, but he had not a clue of what they meant. So in verse 8, Pharaoh was troubled because no advisor could interpret the two dreams. And he called for everybody. Called for the whole cabinet. Called for Congress, the Supreme Court, all the scientists, all the king's men, all king's horses? And nobody could give an answer. And Pharaoh's saying, this does not look good. Funny thing. What is Pharaoh supposed to be? He's supposed to be a god. Kind of a finite god. No one could interpret these dreams for Pharaoh. Well, in verses 9 through 36, Pharaoh's cupbearer remembered Joseph, finally after 2 years. He told Pharaoh about Joseph interpreting dreams. So Joseph interpreted Pharaoh's dreams, giving all credit to God, and advised Pharaoh about how to conduct himself during the next 14 years. In verses 9 through 13, the cupbearer remembered Joseph and told Pharaoh that he explained dreams. Verses 9 through 13. Then the chief butler, or better, cupbearer, because it's the one who gives drink, for the Hebrew term, spoke to Pharaoh, saying, I remember my faults this day. When Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker, we each had a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now there was a young Hebrew man with us there, a servant of the captain of the guard. And we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. Each man he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came to pass, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office, and he hanged him. So he's saying, yeah, I remember this fellow that was there in the prison, and he interpreted my dream, and he interpreted the baker's dream, and things happened exactly like he said that the dream meant. Well, obviously, Pharaoh's going to be very interested because he hasn't found anyone that's able to interpret dreams, the dreams that he had. So in verse 14, Pharaoh summoned Joseph so that he could interpret the two dreams. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph and brought him quickly out of the dungeon, and he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh. So instant change of fortune for Joseph. He's suddenly brought before Pharaoh in order that he can help Pharaoh out. And you notice that he's made presentable. And that's so he's able to shave, shower, change his clothes. Obviously not changing his clothes into a different set of stripes, but into something a little more acceptable for an audience with the king. And now he's going to have an opportunity before Pharaoh. So in verses 15 and 16, Pharaoh said that he heard about Joseph interpreting dreams. Joseph said that God is the interpreter of dreams. This is not a one-on-one audience. There are going to be others present. The entire court of Pharaoh is likely to be present. All of his advisors. Because the idea would be, well, if this man gives an interpretation that is clearly false, all of the advisors ought to be able to say that it is bogus. They're all going to be present. So, in verses 15 and 16, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I have heard it said of you that you can interpret a dream, and you can understand a dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. Joseph is saying, it's not something special in me. It's my God. Now, how's that for political correctness? You walk up to a president, one who says, we're just about the biggest Muslim nation in the world, and you tell them about our God, You'd be kind of taking your life in your hands, wouldn't you? Joseph walks up to a man who thinks he's God, and he says, "Well, I can't answer you, but God can." And if Pharaoh, who thinks he's a god, and all of his advisors can't answer him, and his advisors are including all of the priests of their pantheon, and they can't answer, that's clearly pointing to a god who's superior to all the so-called gods of Egypt. Joseph had better deliver. If he came up empty after making a statement like this, he'd be in pretty deep water. He'd be in real trouble because he's really built up. Okay, well, hands down, God is going to give you the answer. And it's an answer of peace. The idea is, this is going to be one that's going to resolve the situation, and you're not going to be wondering, maybe I ought to ask someone else what it means. Maybe I need someone else. Maybe I need a second opinion. Joseph says, God's going to give you a satisfying answer because it's the right answer, because the giver of the interpretation is also the giver of the dream. God is in the business of revealing, and God is able to give his revelation in a hidden form, as he did to the cupbearer, as he did to the baker, and as he did to Pharaoh. And it required a man of God to be able to interpret that dream. And that's where Joseph came in. He was enabled by God to give the answer. In verses 17 through 24, Pharaoh told Joseph his dream of the 14 cows and his dream of the of the 14 heads of grain. So this is going to be a reiteration of what we heard earlier, verses 17 through 24. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Behold, in my dream I stood on the bank of the river. Suddenly seven cows came up out of the river, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. Then behold, seven other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt, such ugliness as I have never seen in all the land of Egypt. And the gaunt and ugly cows ate up the first seven, the fat cows. When they had eaten them up, no one would have known that they had eaten them, for they were just as ugly as at the beginning. So I awoke. Also I saw in my dream, and suddenly seven heads came up on one stalk, full and good. Then behold, seven heads withered, thin, and blighted by the east wind sprang up after them. And the thin heads devoured the seven good heads. So I told this to the magicians, but there was no one who could explain it to me." Now you've heard that happy cows come from California, and they're trying to say that it's not from Minnesota and Wisconsin. But everybody knows that's where the really happy cows are. Pharaoh would say it's in Egypt where the happy cows were. And so he said he never saw such ugly cows ever. So he probably hadn't traveled around enough in Egypt to see some ugly cows. I'm sure there were a few. So he's reiterated this dream, and he says nobody could explain it. And you've just said that God is going to give me an answer of peace. Well, is Joseph shaking in his boots? No, he is not. Joseph is going to give the interpretation that God has supplied. In verses 25 through 32, Joseph interpreted the dreams as both saying that God will most certainly give Egypt 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of severe famine. Verses 25 through 27 then are looking at the first portion of the dream, whereas verses 28 through 31 are going to look at the second part. First part is talking about the cows, and the second part is talking about the heads of grain. And if you compare verses 25 and through 27 with 28 through 31, all the points are covered. And the idea is to strengthen that this is one dream with a single interpretation, although it came in two forms. So let's look at the first part. In verses 25 through 27, Joseph says that both dreams were one. The seven fat cows represent seven abundant years in Egypt. The seven gaunt cows represent 7 years of severe famine in Egypt. Verses 25 through 27. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, "The dreams of Pharaoh are one. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads are 7 years. The dreams are one. And the seven thin and ugly cows which came up after them are 7 years, and the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine." So, he's looking there at the dream, and he's giving the interpretation that's talking about a period of seven good years followed by seven terrible years. This is a completely foreign concept to Pharaoh, who's used to the dependability of that 4,000-mile-long Nile River. And if you ask him, if he talks about rain, he'd say, "What's that?" Because Sesostris II probably hasn't seen rain very often in his life. That is the Pharaoh that I believe is the one who is in power at this time. So, then Joseph will reiterate the point by giving the second portion of the dream and its interpretation, which lines up with that of the first. Verses 28 through 31. "This is the thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. But after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe." And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. Pharaoh has obviously understood that the dreams are parallel. And that's saying that God is at work here, giving two dreams to make one point. God is making it clear this will indeed happen. And so Joseph is now interpreting it as a certain thing that God is about to do, dealing with 7 years of plenty, great plenty. Talks about handfuls of grain. It's just going to be very plentiful. But the famine that follows is going to be so severe that people will forget all about the good times. I remember talking with my parents about their experience of the Depression. They got married in 1935. And you know, they could talk about how, you know, there was a lot of money flowing, a lot of things like that before things hit, and then all of a sudden it tightened up, and you didn't have people when they were in the bread lines talking about the time of plenty. They forgot about it. Not that they forgot it ever happened, but the time of trouble was so severe that it drifted off into once upon a time instead of being something that was at the forefront. That's what's being said about this. It's going to be such a terrible period during that second 7 years that people will not really think of the 7 years of plenty as a real thought, but almost as if it were a dream. Verse 32 says, as we've already read, God has repeated this to show the certainty that God will bring the dreams to pass. Then in verses 33 through 36, Joseph advised Pharaoh to appoint a wise man to set up a plan for storing surplus grain for the 7 abundant years in preparation for the 7 years of famine. Verses 33 through 36. Now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this, and let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming, and store up the grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. Now, people have often said, well, why is it that they're collecting 1/5 each year for 7 years? Looks like they're going to have extra. Well, there probably are a couple of reasons. I'm sure during the good years, the mice and rats were probably busy. They need to have some extra. But what happens if the population starts growing? What happens if there are more people that they're going to need to supply for? And furthermore, they're going to be exporting grain to other nations. So having the extra, the 1/5 each year, is going to make provisions that they're not going to run out, so that they're going to be able to sell a certain amount and still have enough of a reserve to make it through the 7th year, so that the 8th year there can be a replenishment. How is it that they're able to determine these percentages? God has revealed it. Because God knows what's going to happen, and God has given Joseph enough information that Joseph is going to be the deliverer, not only for Egypt, but for his own brothers and father. So, Joseph is giving advice to Pharaoh as to how they can make it through this period of time. Pharaoh doesn't have the slightest clue how to handle this because they're used to having enough grain each year. They're just used to storing grain during the off-season. They don't need to supply up large amounts and build up a reserve to handle 7 years of severe famine when hardly any food will be coming in. So that's why he says you need to appoint a wise person in charge and then have overseers who will be under him in order to carry this out. So, in verses 37 through 57, Pharaoh perceived that God has made Joseph wise. So he appointed him as his second in command over Egypt, gave him a wife who bore Manasseh and Ephraim to him. At the outset, verses 37 through 45, Pharaoh gave Joseph authority over Egypt as number 2, renamed him, and gave him a wife. Let's look at 37 through 45. So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh, and in the eyes of all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you." And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring, his credit card, off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. And he had him ride on the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, "Bow the knee." So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, "I am Pharaoh, and with out your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah. And he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. You notice in verse 37, the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh. This is a thumbs up. It says, that's the answer. I've been looking for this. Nobody could give this kind of an answer. And does Pharaoh say, you're talking about God giving it to you. You're just a smart guy. You went to Harvard. No. Pharaoh recognizes that this has come from God. Look at what he says. And he says it before all of his servants. And yet, what is Pharaoh? Pharaoh is supposed to be a god. And he says this before all of his servants. Before all the administration. Can we find such a one as this? A man in whom is the Spirit of God. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning as wise as you. Pharaoh recognizes the caliber of this revelation that has been given is that it is an answer. Truly, Joseph was correct when he said this was an answer of peace from God. This is a satisfying answer. Pharaoh says, this makes sense. Pharaoh didn't say, this will never happen. The Nile River is so dependable. Pharaoh recognizes it as true. So notice how he's given a great promotion. He sets him up in a rulership position as number two. He could be called prime minister. He's in charge of commerce and agriculture. He is powerful. He gives him the signet ring, verse 42. And he was already clothed nicely to go before Pharaoh, but now he is clothed in fine linen. Linen before the cotton gin was very expensive because the seeds had to be pulled out of each tuft of cotton before you could weave it into cloth. We think of cotton as cheap. They didn't. This was extremely expensive. He's clothed in fine linen and has a gold chain around his neck. And he gets to ride in the second limousine, second chariot. And they bend the knee as Pharaoh goes by, and they don't get up. When he goes by, they wait until Joseph has gone by before they get up. So if the two chariots are going by, Pharaoh goes first, people are on their knees, and then it's not until after Joseph passes that they're allowed to stand. Whereas before, Pharaoh passes and they can stand. Now they have to stay on their knees until Joseph gets by. Pharaoh is saying to the people, you're under his thumb as well as mine. I mean, Joseph has had a meteoric rise to power. Then notice in verse 45, he gave him a new name. And this name, I don't have any expertise, so I'm here dependent upon how those would interpret the Egyptian words that this comes from. Ross interprets it as God speaks and lives. Because God spoke in giving the dreams to Pharaoh, And God spoke through Joseph to interpret the dreams. But God lives. Very significant for the name that Pharaoh has chosen to give to Joseph. And it is in accordance with him recognizing that Joseph has been given truth from God. Notice he has a wife here. She's an Egyptian, a daughter of a priest. You might say, uh-oh, maybe trouble brewing? I don't think so. It could be very interesting as we follow what happens from here. In verse 46 through 49, it tells us how Joseph was the second in command over Egypt during the seven abundant years. What we saw in this preceding passage is what happened before the 7 years began. So we're in year zero. But as we move to verses 46 through 49, then we have Joseph in power at the time of the abundance. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout the land of Egypt. Now in the seven plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. It brought forth by handfuls. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years, that is the surplus food, the one-fifth, and laid up the food in the cities where it could be protected. And he laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. So Joseph is able to travel up and down the Nile River throughout the area controlled by Egypt, and they are having grain coming in with into tremendous amounts of grain, and then they are making provision for it to be stored in various cities that it can be distributed. Now, verses 50 through 52. Joseph had two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And to Joseph were born two sons before the years of famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, which is he who brings to forgetfulness. With this change in fortune, Joseph is no longer thinking of the time that he was thrown into the pit, the time he was taken by the Midianite slave traders, the time that he was sold into slavery, the time that he went into prison under false charges. He's seeing God starting to deliver him in the way that God had said that he would through the dreams. So he's reflecting the change in his status by the name of his first son, Manasseh. There's something you may not recognize, though, that is extremely significant about the name Manasseh. It is not an Egyptian name, it is a Hebrew name. His wife has an Egyptian name. His sons have Hebrew names. Who do you think's in charge of the spiritual well-being of this household, even though his wife is a daughter of a priest of a false god? Joseph is in charge. Joseph hasn't forgotten. And then, in verse 52, the name of the second he called Ephraim. That's a dual ending. For God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. The If it were a singular ending, it would be fruitfulness, but this looks like double fruitfulness. And interestingly enough, the secondborn was the one who got the firstborn rights, because remember the crossing of the arms? So double fruitfulness is the one who got the double portion as firstborn, even though he wasn't the first one born. I find it very significant with the naming of these two sons. Joseph is going to be very concerned about his relationship with the Lord through the rest of this book. So this is just kind of an inkling as to the character of Joseph. He saw in his first son, forgetting what his bad estate had been, and now he's seeing production. That which is being enabled by God that is ultimately going to deliver his brothers. And can you imagine him thinking, this dream that Pharaoh had. There are going to be lots of people coming here to get food. And you can imagine, he's thinking, 14 years from now, I expect to see my family. Because Joseph is figuring out what is going on. Now in verses 53 to 57, Egypt and foreign nations came to Joseph for food during the seven-year famine. So this is looking at an overview of his ruling as number two during the second 7 years. Then the 7 years of plenty, which were in the land of Egypt, ended. And the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. The famine was in all lands, the whole Nile River and beyond. But in the land of Egypt there was bread, that is, there was food. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, "Go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, do." The famine was over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened up all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain because the famine was severe in all lands. That which God used to elevate Joseph is also going to be the provision by which he is going to be a blessing to all families of the earth. You remember Genesis 12:3. Remember how many times we've gone back to this. We have seen how Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had a hard time with that, didn't they? They had a hard time being a blessing like they were supposed to be. And why do we receive such a long portion of this book devoted to Joseph? It is to see that in the process of God pouring out blessing upon Israel, it is also designed to go beyond Israel, as it does very much here. Genesis 12:3 and the repetitions of it through Genesis are extremely important in this book, and this is helping us to see where this book is going. When the reader of Genesis looks at this, they say, are we supposed to be tricking everybody like Jacob? Or giving our wife away as our sister? Are we supposed to be like that, or are we supposed to see in Joseph the model for God's blessing going out? I think the answer is self-evident. Well, just imagine if God hadn't given the revelation. There would have been a day that Pharaoh would have had a malaise speech, wouldn't there? And it would have been a sad day in Egypt. But because of the way that God had raised up Joseph to protect not only that country, but to protect the Israelites, to protect his brothers, and to make it so that they could be taken out from amongst the Canaanites who they were a little too friendly with, God made provision. Just as I believe he raised up someone to end the time of malaise and make it so that the United States had something to look up to and, wasn't it interesting? A time of prosperity for the United States also became a time for unprosperity for the Soviet Union? Remember how they, without missiles being fired, without nuclear weapons being dropped, they kind of fizzled. And Reagan could stand up and tell Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and what happened? That wall came down. God works through blessing whenever it is possible. There are obviously times it isn't possible. We see in the Bible wars, do we not? And we're going to see Jesus Christ leading armies at the Battle of Armageddon, will we not? But God's policy is to seek to bless those who bless. And interestingly enough, in Egypt, people were trying, other than Potiphar's wife, to bless Joseph, weren't they? And what did God do? God blessed them. Very, very interesting. We get a glimpse into how God wants his word, his revelation, to go forth. Any questions about this passage?